This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Jim Nickel, former chairman of the board of WRKF and former chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, now a prominent lobbyist in Baton Rouge and beyond. We will talk with Jim Nickel about the political landscape and the LSU season opener. Next year shapes as a big year politically, of course, with Mary Landrieu seeking a fourth term in the U.S. Senate. And LSU opens Saturday night at Cowboys Stadium against TCU. Jim Nickel will be in the broadcast booth as the spotter for the LSU team. Also, Lisette Oropesa, the fabulous soprano from Baton Rouge, doing great work in New York and back home in a few days. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757 outside the Baton Rouge area. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Kevin Gallagher producing. And Jim Nickel is in the guest chair for the first time in a while. The prominent lobbyist, former chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, and former chair of WRKF. I think you were the chairman of the board 8 years ago when Hurricane Katrina swept through our state. You recall that day?
I do recall that day. And then you and I were talking about it before the show and how we certainly anticipated that it was going to be a tough strike on Louisiana. It was going to hit New Orleans, which was always the fear, the hurricane coming up the river. Certainly didn't anticipate the levees giving way. So 8 years ago today, I was in my office, I think, or maybe at home trying to get ready for a hurricane, but certainly not anticipating the results. I remember I ended up keeping a couple of reporters at my house who would go in and out of New Orleans. They stayed at our house. They were looking for a place to stay. Someone from the Financial Times and someone from, I think, the London newspaper stayed there. So it was certainly a challenging time and a tough time for our state, but also an interesting time.
Nearly 2,000 people died, $81 billion in estimated damage from Hurricane Katrina, the most expensive storm in U.S. history. And that storm kind of shaped the image of Mary Landrieu. In a good way, she, I think, has benefited from this disaster, as politicians sometimes do. I think George Bush, for example, benefited from 9/11.
Sure.
Next year, she's up for re-election, 9 years post-Katrina. She's had three tough ones. How's this one shaping up?
Oh, I think it's going to be another tough one. I mean, Senator Landrieu would probably acknowledge that all her races are tough. But she seems to be going into this one prepared. She's been in the state all of August, I think 27 straight days she's been at it. And I've actually seen her at a few public events. She seems to be very forceful and strong with her message. Doesn't seem to be backing down in any way. She's never been one to back down. She wants to talk about the opportunities Louisiana has if she's reelected. She could potentially be the chairman or chairwoman of the Senate Energy Committee. She would, of course, rise on the charts of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Those are important. I mean, if you look at the history of our congressional delegation, when Russell Long stepped down back in 86, Bennett was well on his way to being a senior member of the Senate. When Bennett stepped down, Breaux had moved up pretty high. Bob Livingston had moved up on appropriations. Billy Tozan was chairman of Commerce. So we've historically kept a pretty deep bench in Washington with seniority. With Rodney Alexander's resignation and potentially Mary Landrieu not going back, we would have probably the most inexperienced or lack of seniority delegation we've had in probably 100 years. So she's talking about that a lot, and it's resonating in some places. No doubt a tough race for her under any circumstance.
You know Bill Cassidy pretty well. Mm-hmm. He's done well in 10 years since he entered politics, but does he have what it takes to beat a seasoned campaigner and elected official like Senator Landrieu?
I wouldn't underestimate him. I can certainly remember, and, you know, I hate to keep going back to the 86, but when John Breaux ran against Henson Moore, that was a 676-day campaign. And in the first year of that campaign, a lot of people went to Breaux or to the Democrats and said, this Breaux guy, he doesn't have it. I mean, he doesn't have the stump style. He's not ready to be a U.S. senator. We don't think he can beat Henson Moore. And Breaux grew during that race. And so for folks to think that Bill Cassidy somehow can't beat Mary Landrieu because he's not charging at her right away, I think is a mistake. I mean, candidates grow, at least good ones, during campaigns. It's way too early to estimate whether Cassidy has the ability to beat Landrieu.
Today, James Gill has a column pointing out that Bill Cassidy supported universal health care, offered a bill when he was in the state legislature, and that's been his big issue thus far. When it comes down to voting in November of next year, will people really take that into account, or is that what do you think?
Well, that's just the ongoing struggle within the Republican Party as to, are you Republican enough? And that's something Cassidy's going to have to deal with, like a lot of people around this country. Mitch McConnell, the majority leader of the United States Senate, the minority leader of the United States Senate, is a Republican. He's being challenged of his Republican credentials in his own state, in his own primary. So, yeah, your past comes back to haunt you, particularly when you are challenged by some of the more conservative elements of your party, and if it's a Democrat, the more liberal elements of your party, and he's going to have to take those things on and deal with them, no doubt about it.
And I'm sure Senator Landrieu will run a vigorous campaign and probably will point out that Congressman Cassidy spent most of his career, and still does, as a matter of fact, as a practitioner in a public health system.
Sure did. He was a very, very well liked and respected physician at Earl K. Long, and has probably transitioned, I don't know, into some of the care that goes on at Our Lady of the Lake with the same patients. So, sure, he's, but also that's a two-edged sword. Dr. Cassidy, Congressman Cassidy, very knowledgeable about health care, and he will be formidable on that issue.
297-5633 is your number, and we will go to the phone lines in short order. Any chance Bobby Jindal will get in that race?
You know, that's been speculated for so long. I think the governor has said it as clearly as he can say it. I'm not running for the U.S. Senate. If Cassidy somehow were to stumble and the Republicans who think this is a great opportunity for them to pick up a seat think he can't deliver, I'm sure they will go to the governor and ask him to look at it again. But for now, I say Jindal does not run for the U.S. Senate.
877-217-5757 outside the area. We go downtown to Dan. Dan, downtown, you're on with Jim Nickel. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Yes, Mr. Nickel, have these close races in a red state caused Senator Landrieu to recommend very conservative appointees, judges and such to President Obama?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think most of the time, at least in my experience with Senator Breaux, that those appointments are as non-political as they possibly can be. Certainly you look to people you know well and people who you have respect for in their particular field, whether it's someone recommending for a federal judge or for an appointment as head of the federal agricultural program in Louisiana. So I don't think Senator Landrieu will be extremely political in her recommendations, but certainly she will be balanced. And I think if you look at her record, she has been. There's been a good number of African Americans here in the Middle District, which we never had before, and she's certainly done her part in making sure that women are now on the federal bench, which was way overdue in Louisiana. So I think we'll see balance in that regard.
When you were chair of the Democratic Party, the party was in control of the state as far as the politics. That, of course, is no longer the case, and it swung completely the other way in a statewide level. What happened?
Well, I don't know. I think certainly Louisiana for a long time was the holdout. I mean, you and I have talked about that before. I mean, Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and Tennessee, traditional southern states, had flipped long before Louisiana did. I think that Senator Breaux and some of the moderate Democrats that had a foothold in Louisiana were able to hold on to that coalition, and over time it's eroded. And I don't know what to say about it. I think it's a tough time for Democrats in the South. Certainly, if you look at Arkansas, Senator Pryor's up for re-election. He's in a tough race. The Arkansas governor's race is going to be a tough race. So I think it's been very, very difficult for Democrats in the South, and that's no reflection on the party leadership or the candidates. It's just a sign of the times.
If Landrieu were to lose, I would think it might be a death knell for the Democratic Party in Louisiana.
Going to be tough. I mean, you've got to have that leader. You've got to have someone out there who's a beacon for other candidates at lower levels or at other levels. I mean, there are people out there that are thinking about one day running for Congress or running for Senate or running for governor, and they want to see that a Democrat can win statewide. If she were to not be successful, you're right. That would certainly cause a lot of problems in recruiting and encouraging people to run for that next level.
We're a couple of years away, although the campaigning will start well before that, and in fact, it really already has. Well, how do you size up the governor's field, the candidates running for the state's highest office in 2015?
Well, the big question, Mark, is who is not running yet. I mean, a lot of people anticipate that Senator Vitter is looking at this race. He has the time and the luxury of waiting. He is, to me, the elephant in the room, pardon the pun. I mean, if he runs, he's a formidable fundraiser, formidable political candidate, a tireless campaigner. He will be tough to beat if he runs. If he doesn't run, certainly Darden is a strong candidate. Whether Vitter runs or not, I think Darden's a strong candidate, but it becomes a different race. Scott Angell has to look at the race. If Vitter doesn't run, he would be a formidable Republican as well. And then on the Democratic side, John Bel Edwards is well on his way to organizing and trying to pull together a coalition of traditional Democratic votes to do it. I think if the Democrats are able to keep it to one strong candidate, he or she would have the opportunity to get in the runoff. The bigger question mark seemed to be on the Republican side, who's in, who's out. We'll have to see. Certainly there will be no shortage of candidates. Everybody in Louisiana seems to want to be governor at some point.
David in St. Francisville, you're on the air with Jim Nickel. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine.
Jim, here's my question. At some point in time, the Democrats and Republicans are going to have to come together to start solving some of our problems, and particularly when it comes to the budget deficit. When are we going to get to a point where a candidate can run and say, my main objective is to work with the people on the other side to get something done? And it would seem like Mary Landrieu ought to be someone that could make that point and say, hey, I'm willing to be conservative where I need to be conservative to try to work and pull people together. But it just seems like that's anathema. When is that going to change?
You know, David, that's a great question. And it's interesting you ask it because I have been asked by numerous politicians in the last year that very same question, moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats who want to work with people but yet are fearful that amongst their party base they will be attacked for being cooperative, for being compromising, for being someone who wants to reach across party lines. If you look at the Times-Picayune today, there's an article about this fiscal hawk group that met in New Orleans over the weekend and invited some leaders of the Black Caucus, some leaders of the Democratic Caucus to meet with them. Tyler Bridges on the on his website talked about how there was an alliance between Republicans and some Democrats, and the Republicans jumped out real quickly and called the Picayune. It's in the paper this morning online where they reject this alliance and said, oh, no, we don't work with Democrats. There's no alliance here. You're right, David. There is a time now in American politics and in Louisiana politics where it is not considered kosher within your party to be someone who works with other people. I think that's why my old boss John Breaux walked away, and I think that's why you see other people don't want to run for office, because it is you're penalized for being that type of political leader. I think Mary Landrieu does work across party lines, and I do think you see that her voting record by most Democratic standards is pretty conservative, and she will be attacked by Democrats for doing that. And you see Congressman Cassidy, who I think has had some moderate records in the past, having to move more to the right to earn the support of the Republican Party. It's an unfortunate development. I think there's a lot of reasons why, and I could go into those. We don't have time, but the fact of the matter is David, you're right. Right now, you're not rewarded for being a bridge builder. You're rewarded for being a bridge blow-upper, if there's such a word.
Your old boss, John Breaux, he and Trent Lott were best friends. They're in business together now. That doesn't happen today.
Well, look, when John Breaux and Trent Lott got elected, they didn't know each other. They were both young congressmen, one from Mississippi, one from Louisiana. And back then, you moved to Washington. You moved your young family. You bought a house in Annandale, Virginia. Your kids went to school together. You went to the same church, which he and Lott were both Catholic, both went to church together. They were godfathered to each other's children. They went to T-ball games together. Their wives probably cooked rice and gravy together, and they ate. And they had a normal family life together, and that resulted in a friendship that was able to produce policies. We don't have that in Washington anymore.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Another segment with Jim Nickel, former chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, now top lobbyist in Baton Rouge, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Jim Nickel is with us. He began his career in politics at very high levels in the U.S. Senate race between John Breaux and Henson Moore. He was the state field director for then-Congressman Breaux at the age of, what, 24?
Mm-hmm.
24 years old. That's one of the remarkable things is that on these campaigns, even today, the staffs at high levels are quite often quite young.
Well, you need to be young because you got to start early in the morning and go late at night and go 7 days a week, and you got to have that kind of young motor to keep up. So, I think you see a lot of young people in politics, and the ones that are willing to get there early and stay late are the ones that succeed. It just takes a lot of hard work, but it was fun. I had the time of my life in campaigns, certainly the Breaux campaign, the Clinton campaigns in Louisiana. That was back in the day when you did the caravans. You know, you got in the bus and you traveled all over the state, and I loved it. Growing up in Crowley, having spent most of my life south of I-10, to actually get up and go and see, you know, mm-hmm. the northern parts of the state, it was Farmerville and all those small little places. I loved it.
Probably hit all 64 parishes in that campaign.
Yep, sure did.
Which at the time was the most expensive U.S. Senate race in history.
Correct. And now we probably will see between Cassidy, Landrieu, and outside parties in excess of $20 million spent in the state, maybe $30 million. I think after all the independent expenditures in the two campaigns, it'll be big bucks.
Trudy on College Drive. Good morning, Trudy. You're on the air with Jim Nickel.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a question. I thought that the Congress's job is to represent their constituents and to, of course, pass legislation. However, it seems that they've forgotten about the constituents, because they keep fighting each other, and they're fighting and attacking the White House all the time. And it doesn't matter who's in the White House, they keep attacking the White House. And I'm just wondering when they're going to come back and do what they're supposed to do.
All right.
A great question. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at polling, Congress is at its lowest numbers in history as a body, but people tend to like their individual congressman or congresswoman. And that's quite a dilemma. I don't know what to tell you, Trudy. I think, you know, when you say that Congress's job is to pass laws, there's some people who don't necessarily agree with that. They may think it's perfectly fine if Congress doesn't pass any laws because we've got enough of them. But certainly we've got challenges as a country that need to be spoken about and discussed in a serious and adult manner. And that entire dialogue seems to have dissipated, and that is unfortunate. Whether they actually get anything done, to me, is not as discouraging as the fact that they can't even talk to each other. That seems to be, to me, the biggest problem in Washington right now.
Tracy asks about the battle to become the successor to Dan Juneau as LABI president. Fierce battle. Looks like Stephen Waguespack is going to win it with the help of Governor Jindal. What do you think?
Well, for those who don't know what we're talking about, this is a little insider pool. Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, LABI, is the organization that represents big and small businesses on a lot of issues in Baton Rouge, and is a very, very formidable political and business organization. Dan Juneau has led that organization for, I think, 30, 35 years, a long time. Dan's stepping down, and anytime you have a new leader picked, it becomes, particularly after that long of a tenure, it's a pretty significant transition. And they had some major candidates. The two finalists that seemed to be public were former Speaker Jim Tucker and Stephen Waguespack, who was executive counsel and then chief of staff to Governor Jindal. I don't know what the results are. The word is that Waguespack's got the job, but both of them are good candidates. I mean, look, those are big shoes to fill. Dan Juneau did an amazing job. Whether you agree or disagree with him on policy, Dan was formidable, and he built that organization into a real powerhouse. I think, you know, Stephen will do fine. He will grow into the job. He's a young, accomplished guy. He was well-liked in the Capitol, and he'll be fine. You just got to give him some time. Whether the governor helped him get it or not, it to me, I don't know if that happened. I have no direct knowledge of that, but, you know, governors help people all the time. So, I mean, this would not be the first governor who's helped the first friend of his get a job in an organization.
297-5633 is your number. But governors tend to like to leave legacies, and Governor Jindal, of course, is 42, so he quite possibly will be running for office in Louisiana once again if he doesn't win the presidency.
Sure.
It looks like he's running for president, though.
Certainly looks like it. I mean, he's doing all the things you do to run for president, spending time in Iowa and in New Hampshire and building a I think he's got a political action committee. I'm not sure, but he's doing all the things to get in that position. Now, whether he's successful in being the Republican nominee and the president of the United States, it really doesn't in the end matter so much as that he is a player on the field and thus a potential cabinet member or a potential leader of a major organization in Washington. He is, as you said, a young man, and if he's going to continue to be a player on the field, he's got to stay on the field. He can't just roll up his carpet and go home and, you know, forget about it. He wants to be a player. He's got to stay out there.
Now, Governor Jindal and David Vitter, I don't think there's any secret, they don't particularly care for one another. And Congressman Cassidy has apparently chosen the Vitter team to assist him in his run for the U.S. Senate. And Vitter's never lost a race. He is a U.S. senator. In one way, it makes sense, but in another way, it alienates him potentially with the governor. What do you think? How will that play out?
Oh, we'll see. I mean, you know, this is the part of the challenge of having a growing Republican Party. I mean, that used to be a dilemma on the Democratic side, right? You were a John Brough Democrat or you weren't, or you were an Evan Edwards Democrat or you were not. And, you know, you had certain Democrats with you and certain Democrats against you. Well, now the Republican Party has grown in Louisiana to the point where you have these inter-family squabbles. And we'll have to see. I don't think there's any doubt. In the end, they'll all come together. The seat's too important to them. But for now, sure, you'll have these little squabbles amongst the family, but they'll be private. They won't be public to any extent. They'll get it figured out. If they want to win the race, they better figure it out.
But if Senator Vitter helps Congressman Cassidy become a U.S. senator, then Vitter gets elected governor, which is a possibility, and then he gets to appoint his successor to the U.S. Senate.
Yes.
That makes him the most powerful politician in this state in some time.
Yes, he will have had his imprint on a number of positions. There's no doubt about it. But look, anytime you're the governor of Louisiana, even if he didn't get these appointments, he would still be a very powerful person. But Senator Vitter is a hard, hard worker. And he will be, you know, involved in everything that he can possibly be involved in. And so, you know, look, this is something in Louisiana that we've seen over time where we get people who understand how politics works in Louisiana and they work real hard at it and they want to have their hand in a lot of different areas. And it's not anything new to me. It's just a new guy doing it.
And if Senator Vitter has power, I think it's a certainty he will use power.
Well, most effective leaders do. I mean, you know, certainly this governor has used his power. Some have not liked it. Some have liked it. But what's the use of having it if you don't use it?
Some use it in different ways, though.
Of course.
And this governor has taken aim at his enemies. You know, there's one thing to rewarding your friends, which he's trying to do with Stephen Wagespack. But this governor and others, but this one, surprisingly to some, has been tough.
He has been tough, but you know what? I mean that is an effective tool as a leader. I mean your opponents have to know that you're not going to sit idly by and let them do whatever they want. And he has been tough, and he's taken a lot of flack for being tough. Certainly, look, whether you agree or disagree with the way he did health care reform, the fact of the matter is he tackled an issue that we've been facing in Louisiana for 80 years. What do we do about our charity hospital system? And whether you like it or not like it, he tackled, you know, some situations at LSU where we've had a lot of, you know, disparity, and now he's trying to bring it under one organization, and people have a problem with that. Change is difficult. Whether you agree or disagree, he's used the power of the governorship to affect change. And sometimes that means being tough on your opponents. And I don't think that's any different than Evan Edwards and other governors who have been tough on their opponents. He just may have been a little more public about it, but the fact of the matter is when you're tough, you're tough.
HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on the air with Jim Nichol.
Good morning. Mr. Nichols, I've read several articles over in my lifetime whereby it's been stated that really on a, not only Louisiana level but on a national level, the lobbyists, when you speak of power, have too much power over the influence of our senators and our representatives. Would you agree or disagree with that assessment and those published articles? Thank you, sir.
Great question. I think in certain instances that's possible. Yeah, lobbyists have a lot of influence over the system. And I think if you have a really it's like anything else. If you have a really strong elected leader, lobbyists will have some impact but will not control him or her. Just like if you had a strong radio host. I mean, nobody's going to come in here and take over Jim Inkster's show. Jim Inkster runs this show. He's going to let you speak, but to a great extent, this is his show. And that makes him a good radio host. And if you have a good state senator, he or she is going to listen to lobbyists, but they're also going to listen to other people, and ultimately they're going to make their own decision. Everybody has a lobbyist. I mean, look, if you're a member of any organization or if you have any in any way involvement with the government, chances are somebody out there is arguing on your behalf as a lobbyist. Good lobbyists serve a good role. They inform, and if you're a credible lobbyist, you tell both sides. If I was lobbying Senator Inkster right now, I would tell him that I need his help on a certain issue, but if I'm smart, I'm going to tell him the downside of helping me on that issue and where he may have some problems, and he has to weigh that decision ultimately. So, look, we can all blame somebody else. I've been saying for a long time, I'm going to make T-shirts, America, it's not my fault. You know, everybody wants to blame somebody else for their lot in life. It's not the lobbyist's fault, and it's not just the congressman's fault. It's the whole system has to be basically looked at, and we all have to create a more civil dialogue amongst each other in order to get things done. That includes lobbyists.
Well, you were on the show, I guess, a couple of years ago and said that you thought term limits had given lobbyists more clout mm-hmm. in Baton Rouge. I still
subscribe to that. I think term limits is one of the worst things we ever did. I think it's the only look, and government is the only vocation in our society, major institution in our society, where we penalize experience. I mean, priests become bishops and doctors become head of hospitals and experienced lawyers become judges and bank loan officers become bank presidents. And here we are in government. Just when you figure out what's going on, we ask you to hit the door. We have a $32 billion budget in Baton Rouge, and these legislators are expected to come in and know every nuance of this budget within a 5 to 6 year period. It's not possible. And the vacuum is filled by two things: staff who are there. As the legislators come and go, the staff stays there. As the legislators come and go, the lobbyists stay there. And I think that is unnecessary. I think we have term limits. They're called elections. If you don't like what they're doing, don't vote for them. But to just systematically throw people out just as they know what's going on, to me, is foolish.
Jim Nickel wears a few different hats, and one of those is the spotter for LSU football. This is your third year?
I think it's my fifth year, I think. Fourth or fifth. I don't count. Huh? I'm not as good at that as you are.
It's
certainly not my third. Okay. I think it's my fourth.
Well, it's
Who am I to challenge Jim Inkster on memory?
You've had some good seasons.
Yes.
And this one shapes up as another good one, but tough test Saturday night. And what do you think about TCU and LSU?
Look, I think that LSU has got, a ton of talent, a lot of speed. I think to some extent I like this year because we're a little underestimated, and I think we're a little hungrier than we may have been last year. And so I like that combination of us going in. I think Mettenberger is going to be better. I think, the offensive line is going to be really good. They're just not going to have a whole lot of depth with some of the injuries we've had. And the linebackers are new, but we're going to shift them in and out, which we don't usually do as much as we did with the defensive line. So to make a long story short, I think we're going to be a lot of fun. I do think Cam Cameron's going to have an impact on the offense, and I think we're going to be an exciting team to watch. We have the toughest schedule, certainly, I think, in the conference, maybe one of the toughest in the country with the road games that we have. We got to go to Georgia. We got to go to Alabama. We got to go to Ole Miss, who is getting better and better. We'll see them tonight. So people need to understand that this is a tough business. So this man went 13-0 2 years ago, which is a phenomenal accomplishment. Even Nick Saban hasn't gone 13-0, but he's certainly won some national championships. So
he did it at Alabama.
He did it at Alabama. But I think it's exciting, and I think it's fun. And I think if we take it a game at a time and let this team grow, we're going to see a lot of excitement towards the end. And we're going to have some bumps along the way. But I'm excited. I love football. I love high school football. I love college football. And I can't wait till the whole thing gets cranked up, and it does tonight. So,
well, the non-conference schedule at home is a little paltry.
Kent State,
and UAB.
Yes.
So the schedule is tough, but there's some breathers in there as
sure.
well.
And there's an open date before Alabama, and I think one after. So,
correct.
So we'll have some cushion there. But look, you traveled with the team as a member of the media for some time. Those road games are tough. And to go to Georgia and to Alabama, that's two tough trips.
Well, I traveled with the team, but not on the same plane as the team. But Jim Nickel, he boards the same plane, right?
We'll be heading out tomorrow. I think at 1 o'clock we'll be in Dallas by 2:15, and we will it'll be a late game, 8 o'clock kickoff. And then we'll fly home after the game. So we'll be in about 2 o'clock Sunday morning.
Well, when I was covering LSU, you could still be my size and be a player on the team. But now the thing that is most remarkable is the huge size of these people.
It's interesting.
Immense,
I tell you,
men.
Yeah. To be able to go to, and honestly, to go to practice is where you really see that. The game certainly is big, but it's hard to tell from the stadium. But to stand on the sideline and see the speed and the size of these people, it's no wonder we have concussions, and it's no wonder we have more injuries in football. These are very, very fast, large men crashing into each other, and it's not for the faint of heart. And you certainly, if you're going to play Division I football, you better strap it on, because these guys are fast, they're big, and they're good.
Jim Hawthorne starts year number 31 as the voice of the Tigers, and his sidekick, Doug Morrow, will miss Saturday's game.
Yeah, Doug's not going to make the trip, we expect him back the next week. He has told us that he's not up to going, and we'll see. That was put out, I think, in the media guide on Monday, so for everybody. But we'll see Doug back at Tiger Stadium, and Gordy Rush will fill in on the broadcast with Jim, and Bill Franquez, who everybody knows from the baseball broadcast, will be on the sidelines, and looking forward to it. That's a great stadium. It's going to be kind of cool to be back there. Certainly the nicest press box I've ever been in.
Well, you must have been at LSU, Jim Nickel. We probably crossed over. I was finishing about the time you started, and that would have been, late 70s, early 80s?
Yes.
You were there during the Jerry Stovall years as a student, right?
Was there for Stovall, and those were some good years and then some tough years. And, you know, it's amazing when you look at how long Coach Miles has been here. I mean, what year is this for Coach Miles?
Ninth year,
which in college football is a long time. We certainly went through a lot of them here at LSU. It's nice to have some stability, and it's nice to be winning year in, year out. And I think everybody needs to enjoy that and not keep wanting the next thing and just enjoy the whole success we've had. We've had a heck of a run.
Well, as I noted Monday with Cody Worsham of Tiger Rag, LSU has won 8 straight openers under Miles, 10 straight openers overall. That's the longest in school history. But Les Miles, 8-0, and some of those openers have been tough games.
Sure. Played Oregon, what was that, 2 years ago?
And North Carolina. A few others.
That's right. So he's a really good football coach. The numbers are there to prove it. And this will be a tough game, I think, early on with TCU, but I like our chances if we can really settle down to take care of business. So be fun. I'm excited about the whole season.
Well, as a spotter, you have to point out all the players that are active on the field at a given time.
Yeah, so the way it works is as soon as they snap the ball, I watch the play with the binoculars, and I point at the players, and I try to help Jim have a good broadcast. That's all I try to do.
I'm sure it'll be a sterling broadcast, thanks to Jim Nickel. Today's first two segments were pretty good, thanks to Jim Nickel. Let's do it again soon, Jim.
Look forward to it, Jim. Thank you.
And we'll be back after this 90-second pause with Lisette Oropesa, the fabulous soprano from Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're pleased to have as our guest at this time Lisette Oropesa. She is a Louisiana treasure, born in New Orleans and raised in Baton Rouge, studied at LSU, and has set the world afire as an opera performer in places like New York. Good morning, Lisette.
Good morning. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, Lisette has been described by the New York Times as an artist with a magnetic stage presence, attractively silky, and you will be coming our way soon, in a few days.
Yeah, that's right. I can't wait. I'm counting down the days.
September the 8th. Of course, you come back frequently, but this is a special event at the Crown Plaza, and you're fresh from some performances elsewhere, in particular with the Santa Fe Opera.
Correct. Yeah, I spent all summer in the high and dry desert out in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Loved it there. You know, so totally different from our Baton Rouge, you know, weather, the heat and the humidity. It was a really amazing experience. It's one of the top houses in the United States, and I had a really good debut there singing a role which I love very much, Susanna in The Marriage of Figaro, which, funny enough, I actually sang for the first time at LSU. So yeah. It was a really nice, that offer means a lot to me because it's one of my first roles. So it was a great experience.
You performed all over the world, in Europe in particular. How have the experiences been in other places outside the United States?
You know, every place has its own magic. You know, with my job, I get to travel to places that some people, you know, live a lifetime dreaming and never get a chance to visit. You know, Paris, London, Munich, you know, places like that. And then places like Santa Fe, you know, which are kind of like people don't really think that they would ever want to go there. But, you know, every place has its own magic. I really have to say that, you know, being in the United States a lot more, it has shown me so much, you know, my country, and really has made me appreciate it in a whole different way. You know, Europe has its own charm, its old world charm, but, you know, the United States of America is such a beautiful country, a beautiful land, and the people here are so warm, and I do love performing here in the States very much.
Lissette Oropesa, not only a rising star, but a full-fledged, in full-bloom star in places like New York, and it all started in Louisiana, and you have credited your time at LSU with being instrumental in your success.
Absolutely. You know, I went straight out of LSU into the Mets Young Artist Program, which is basically kind of like going from the LSU baseball team to the Major League Baseball. I mean, it was such a great training ground for me, not only because of the voice lessons that I got from Mr. Grayson, Robert Grayson, there, but also because of the experience that I got on stage. I was able to sing several roles in full-blown operatic productions, you know, which a lot of schools don't give students the opportunity to do. You know, aside from that, you know, the curriculum itself was really advanced. You know, I was in an excellent choral program with Dr. Kinselton when he was still there. It was a wonderful music theory program. I mean, the whole curriculum was so, so well-rounded, and I really felt like I got an excellent foundation at LSU. And obviously it worked. It did help give me a lot because, I mean, I went straight to the Mets Young Artist Program and straight into a career from that. So, I mean, obviously there's a lot to be said for LSU's music school.
And next season, you'll return to the Met, right?
Yeah, I've been going to the Met every season since I've been there, and next season I'm in two productions, both that are going to be in the HD transmissions in all the movie theaters. And the first one is Falstaff, the last opera written by Verdi, one of his great masterpieces, arguably his greatest masterpiece. And the second opera is Werther, a French opera by Massenet, and I'll be singing the role of the leading lady's sister. Again, another opera that I sang at LSU.
Very good. Lissette is a Cuban-American. Your parents were both immigrants from Cuba.
That's correct. Yeah, my mom came as a young child of seven, and my father came as a young man in his mid-20s. And then they both met and fell in love right there in New Orleans, Louisiana.
And your mother, Rebecca, she's a soprano. She's not bad herself.
You know, Jim, I tell people all the time, my mom is 100 times better singer than I ever was, or I ever will be. But, you know, I was so lucky. My mother had a beautiful soprano voice, absolutely gifted singer, and trained also at LSU for a master's degree. And with Bob Grayson, as a matter of fact, so we've all kind of been friends, you know, for a very, very long time. I remember being a small child and coming to the voice lessons, you know. I used to poke fun at it when I was little, but now I realize that, you know, what my mom was doing was giving me a background foundation for what I would be doing in my future. So, you know, she's been a wonderful influence on my life. It's always great to call someone, you know, when you're in trouble or when you have a question or a concern and have them understand completely what you're talking about and almost always have the perfect solution to fix it. So, and my mother still sings beautifully. She's a school teacher of elementary music right there in Baton Rouge. And so she's changing lives at the ripest young age.
Do you feel like you're just scratching the surface?
Yes. You know, I'm getting ready to turn 30. Actually, I turned 30 in September. You know, and I started my career in opera, I guess, in a major way when I was 21 as a young artist. So it's been a good full-on decade. And I know, you know, with if everything turns out well, you know, a career in opera can last decades. And if you keep singing well and you stay healthy, your career can last, you know, well into past retirement age. And I know that there's so much more. You know, there's the world is huge, and there are many, many, many operas out there that I would love to do and be a part of. You know, I'm just so thankful that I've had any experience with it at all at this age. A lot of people don't even get started in their careers until their 30s or later, and I've already had, you know, 8 years experience. So I'm really happy to be able to say that at my age, I've gone many places and seen many things, and hopefully. I'll continue to do that for the rest of my life because I do love it very much.
Right. Lisette, what are you some of your favorite roles through the years?
Oh, Jim. Uh-oh. Let's see. Well, you know, my favorite roles, they kind of change. But right now, my favorite role that I've ever sung is Lucia di Lammermoor, which is, you know, famous for the mad scene. It's one of Bel Canto's great, great masterpieces and one of every soprano's kind of dream role, especially for my voice type. And whenever I've had the opportunity to sing it, I've sung it about 3 times now, it's been it's different every time. You know, when you come back to a piece that you think you know really well, and then you come back to it a couple of years later, and it's changed in you somehow, psychologically or even musically. And that's something that I love doing. So that's why it's a great role that I really love. I also really love singing the daughter of Rigoletto, Giuda, which is a really beautiful, beautiful role, an extraordinarily challenging role for every single singer in the opera. And those kinds of roles, you know, because they provide such a great challenge, they really bring you to a new level every time you do them. You know, I would love to sing Traviata in the future. I feel like that's a place where a role that, again, another dreamed soprano role. Everybody wants to sing it. I hope that I could bring something to it if and when I ever have the opportunity to sing it. You know, I could go on and on.
As I stated, you performed internationally, but in the United States, you've gotten quite a tour of America. Are there some favorite places along the way outside of Louisiana that you have been?
Yeah, Jim. Like I said, every place has its own magic. But to be honest to God, this past summer in Santa Fe, New Mexico, has been the most gorgeous, rewarding summer I've ever spent anywhere. There is a voodoo there or something. I don't know what they call it, but I don't know if you've ever been to the Southwest. If you ever have the opportunity to go anywhere in the Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, you know, all those places are stunning, not just in their physical beauty, but the people there are so kind. There is a sense, there's an energy of magic, kind of a spirituality in the air that you don't get everywhere. You know, the population isn't incredibly dense. You know, New York is incredibly full of energy, but that's because there are so many people, and it's so dense, and there's so much traffic, and there's so much excitement all the time. You're always on like a constant high. But New Mexico was the complete opposite because there was I never experienced traffic ever there. I didn't even know what traffic meant anymore. I never stood in line for anything. There was never a huge crowd of people. I mean, it was so laid back. But yet the people that were there were so happy and kind, and they look you in the face and smile, you know, kind of reminds me of back home, Louisiana, you know, so opposite from New York, where nobody will look you in the face, you know, to say good morning, much less to actually talk to you. And that was a magical summer for me. This whole summer has been magical. So that's probably my favorite place in the United States that I've ever been. In Europe, my favorite place that I've ever been is Bavaria, Germany. I think it's the most gorgeous land of magic, land of Disney-like glory that I've ever seen. So far, those are my two favorite places.
Well, and I know you like coming home. And Lisette, for those who have not heard her or had the pleasure of seeing her, you not only have the sound, you have the look. You're a beautiful woman. That doesn't hurt, does it?
You know what, Jim? It took me a while to get there. I'll tell you that. I appreciate that. That's a very kind compliment. Thank you. When I first got to the Met, I was young and bubbly, but very overweight and had a lot of health problems. And something that they told me was, you know, that I needed to get my health and look under control because, of course, as a singer in any era, having a nice package is very important. And that's something that I think young singers now have to really focus on a lot more than perhaps in the past. And I guess partially that's due to the HD being so big now, you know, now you go to a movie theater and you see a close-up of a singer's face and you get to see what it really, what they really look like, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so many singers in their prime are not in their 20s. Many times they're in their 40s and 50s. You know, they've got tons of makeup on and wigs and whatnot, and anything you can do for yourself as a human being, but as a singer also, to keep yourself healthy, keep yourself in shape, keep yourself looking as best as you possibly can. Of course, it will help in our jobs, because we are on stage. We are being looked at by many, many people, not only being listened to, but being looked at, being watched and observed. So it's something that I focus a lot in my daily life, on my health and my well-being and fitness, and it's something that has really helped me also very much.
Well, Kevin, let's hear from the spectacular Lisette Oropesa, who sings like few others and looks the part as well.
Oh, thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate it.
Anybody who shows up on September 8th for the event at the Crown Plaza will have quite a treat hearing Lisette Oropesa. The performance begins at 6 o'clock, and for more information, you may call 225-578-4068. That's 225-578-4068. And you'll be joined by another LSU alum, Daniela Mack.
So. Right. Yes, Daniela and I went to school at the exact same time. We're basically the same generation of singers. Another gorgeous Latin American singer, and a really, really gentle, kind woman as well, and a treat to listen to and a treat to sing with. So it'll be a real pleasure to be singing with her on Sunday.
It is remarkable how many talented people come through the doors of the LSU Music and Dramatic Arts program.
Yeah, I mean, people are flocking there, you know, to study, because the staff is so excellent and the curriculum is so good. And obviously the output has been remarkable. So I'm really proud to be among a group of people that can say that we went there. We got a lot out of it, and it set us up for wonderful careers in music.
And I'm sure you have some favorite haunts when you return to your hometown.
Yep. The first thing I'm doing is going to Highland Coffees. And, you know, I used to go to the Chimes restaurant all the time, and I love the Chimes like nobody else. I probably won't go to the Chimes this time around, but I would definitely go to Highland Coffees. It was my favorite place to have coffee, right behind the School of Music, all the time. And, you know, and I miss community coffee. I tell you all the other thing. I order it online and have it shipped to my house because there's no other coffee like it. So, you know, it's one of those, you know, beignets. I have to think about it. I hope I can eat beignets still. You know, I've gone vegan for the past 3 years, and I hope that beignets are still on the menu. I have a feeling they may not be, but I'll be smelling them for sure, at least.
Well, we look forward to your heroic return, and congratulations on your spectacular success, Lisette Oropesa.
Thank you so much, Jim. And everybody, they are welcome to come to my website, lisetteoropesa.com. It's brand new. It's been open just for a little while. We've got pictures and everything in preparation for the gala. So people are welcome to come see my website.
Well, we'll see you soon. Be safe. And
thank you, Tim.
Keep up the great work. Thank you, Lisette.
Thanks so Bye. Much. Take care.
You too. And an email from Donna Britt during our discussion with Lisette. Donna, of course, the great anchor at WAFB for the last 25 years, saying Lissette had a heart of gold in high school. She took her piccolo and rode an elevator to the state capitol, playing impromptu concerts for artists on the Capitol Day. That from Donna Britt. And tomorrow on this show, we'll visit with Steve Monahan, the president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers, and also hear from John Wirt from the Baton Rouge Advocate. A flurry of famous people have been in our city over the last few months since we last visited with Mr. Wirt. We'll talk with him about some of the great concerts that have taken place here and not so far away in New Orleans, among other things, some movies as well that captivated the masses during the summer. And we'll be here with you, same time, same place. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.